It's very good to see so many again. We appreciate all who have given the time to come to the meeting. And we trust there'll be some spiritual blessing for all of us from the Lord's gracious hand. Tonight still remaining, tomorrow on Friday, again at 8 o'clock. And if you're able to be back on those nights, I know you'll be very welcome as well. Now, our readings again from 1 Corinthians and from chapters 7, 8 and 9 tonight. So we'll start reading in chapter number 7. 1 Corinthians and chapter 7, verse number 1. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Verse number 17. But as God hath distributed to every man as the Lord hath called every one, so let him walk, and so ordain I in all the churches. Is any man called being circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Is any called in uncircumcision? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but the keeping of the commandments of God. Let every man abide in the same calling wherein he was called. Art thou called being a servant? Care not for it. But if thou mayest be free, use it rather. Verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that hath obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. I suppose therefore that this is good for the present distress. I say that it is good for a man so to be. Art thou bound unto a wife? Seek not to be loose. Art thou loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. But and if thou marry, thou hast not sinned. And if a virgin marry, she hath not sinned. Nevertheless, such shall have trouble in the flesh, but I spare you. Now verse 38 39. The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth, but if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. But she is happier if she so abide after my judgment. And I think also that I have the Spirit of God. Chapter 8. Now as touching things offered unto idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Verse 7. Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge. For some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eateth as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But meat commendeth us not to God, for neither if we eat it are we better, neither if we eat not are we the worse. But take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak. For if any man see thee, which hast knowledge, sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him which is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through thy knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when ye sin so against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, ye sin against Christ. Chapter 9, verse number 3. Mine answer to them that do examine me is this: have we not power to eat and drink? Have we not power to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as the other apostles, and as the brethren of the Lord and Cephas? Are I only and Barnabas, have not we power to forbear working? Who goeth a warfare at any time at his own charge? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not of the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth a flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man? Or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we reap your carnal things? If others be partakers of this power over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. Now, verse 18. What is my reward then? Verily, that when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I may gain the more, and so on. And I think we conclude the reading there. That's quite a lot of reading, plus fairly broken as well. Now, as most know, we are continuing tonight to make our very hasty progress through the first epistle to the Corinthians. I cannot just take time tonight to recover some of the introductory matters that we did mention on previous nights, but I think even those who are with us for the first time will be able to fairly well take up the thread of thought. That will be aided by the fact that when we commence in chapter 7, I do not say it's a very sharp break, but I do think that the beginning of chapter 7 marks something of a change in this letter. A change in this respect, that in the first 6 chapters, the Apostle Paul has been dealing with reports. You remember way back in chapter 1, he says, reported by the house of Chloe. At the start of chapter 5, he said, it is commonly reported. Reports had come to him, reached his ears, and he dealt with those matters in the first 5 or 6 chapters. From the beginning of chapter 7 onward, he's not dealing with reports, but he's giving replies. Replies to what? Well, it seems that the Corinthians had sent to the Apostle Paul a letter. And in that letter, they raised a number of questions and they made a number of requests from this man. And the greater remaining part of this letter is probably taken up with an answer to the specific questions which they had asked. Some have thought that the reports with which the apostle dealt in the early part of the epistle, those were reports which the Corinthians would have preferred he never had heard. There were certain things they did want to ask him, other things they might just have kept quiet. I'm not altogether sure about that, but at least I am sure that here we have answers. You see, the key to that is verse number 1 of chapter 7. He says, now concerning the things whereof ye wrote me. Verse number 25 of that chapter, he says, now concerning virgins. Chapter 8, verse 1, he says, now as touching things offered unto idols. And we will maybe see in the night or two, he'll say, now as touching or concerning spiritual gifts. So he's going item by item through what these Corinthians have asked him in a letter. Although it is something of a break in the epistle from that standpoint, there doesn't seem to be any change in the apostle's approach. And these questions which we have been looking at in the previous section of the letter, we will find them to be very plentiful in these sections as well. I wouldn't make too much of the count, but I think if you go through your authorized version in chapter 7, 8 and 9, you'll find the question mark coming up something like 28 times. So that these Corinthians may have sent a letter with questions to Paul, but Paul says, I tell you, I'll give you a few questions by way of reply. And oftentimes, as you well know, the best way to answer a questioner's problem is to ask him questions by way of return so that his thinking might be stimulated and that he might be helped to discover and probe and penetrate to find the truth. Generally speaking, you know, we are intellectually lazy. Generally speaking, we really don't want to think. Now that is true. Many of the mistakes that we make in life, and many of the weaknesses that we have, and many of the problems that go in assembly life unsolved for years, is just for want of thought and want of consideration, and we need to be stimulated. It amazes me how many dear brethren, and in their profession, they are brilliant, and they apply their minds to whatever discipline they're involved in, and they apply it with great detail and with great intensity.
And yet it comes to biblical things. And there's a sloppiness. And there's a shoddiness.
And people sometimes read the Bible and they nearly think it's a book of magic. If something jumps out of the page and grabs you, well and good, and if it doesn't, well, you don't bother looking for it. And they would apply themselves to a textbook of human learning, but they wouldn't give the same application to the page of Holy Scripture. All I would say is this: if the books of men deserve such attention, surely the book of God deserves even closer attention. And it's great if we could be prodded into serious thinking.
Now, what is the subject in these three chapters? We have covered on our previous night in a sketchy way questions about unity. Last night we made some comments on the questions which the Apostle Paul asked about the subject of purity. And I think we can prove fairly easily by a look just in a minute at some of the verses that the main subject of these three chapters, 7, 8 and 9, is the subject of liberty. Now, if you have your Bible open and want to look at them, well and good. If not, I'll refer to just a few verses very, very briefly. Chapter 7, he said in verse number 39, "The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth, but if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married." So there's absolutely no question that, at least in part, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it's the subject of liberty. Chapter 8 and verse number 9, he has moved to a different topic, but he says in this verse, "Take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak." So we're still, different topic, but we're still under the umbrella of liberty. Chapter 9 and verse number 12. In the last section of the verse, he says, "Nevertheless, we have not used this power." Now the word "power" in that particular verse is exactly the same word in the original as was translated "liberty" in chapter number 8. So that in each one of these chapters we have a very, very specific reference to liberty, freedom. Obviously, just to recover the ground, this part of it is well known and it will lead us on to rather more practical things. In chapter number 7, the question is marriage. Who is free to marry? Should a person get married at all? Is it something advisable? Freedom in the question of marriage. When we get to chapter number 8, he's speaking about those who are eating meat in conjunction with the idol's temple. So that chapter 8 is, are you free to go there? Free to go to the feast and to eat meat in that place. When you get to chapter number 9, the Apostle Paul, will discover it more in detail presently, he's talking about the servant of the Lord receiving material support from those amongst whom he's working in the gospel. So we have marriage, chapter 7, we have meats in chapter 8, and we have the question of material things, or if you like, money, in chapter number 9. Now, those are three areas that are very sensitive, even to this present day. I mean, not so much the middle one, idols, meat and so on, but by application. Free to marry? Am I free to go there? And what about the use of my finances? So that you can see that we're touching in these chapters upon things that are very practical and things that are very, very far-reaching. Now the whole question of liberty is a very, very important one. You see, we're speaking tonight and will be speaking about things for which we haven't got legislation. We are talking about things, and the Lord does not say, "Thou shalt do this and nothing else." He leaves it up to choice. I have a choice what I do with my money, how I spend it. I have a choice whether or not I go here or whether or not I go there. I have a choice whether or not to get married. Each one of those things, where I go, with whom I'm in relationship, how I spend my time and my money, each one of those things has tremendous implications for a Christian's life. But within that, he has a great amount of choice and he has a great amount of liberty. Now, how do we use the liberty? It's great to have it. How can it be controlled? One thing that I would say, just in, by way of a general introduction at the minute, is this. Because a person has a liberty, does not necessarily mean that he has to use it. Having a liberty, having a freedom, having a right, having an entitlement. You know that we're living in a society, people all know their rights, and they're all crying for their rights, and they're all clamoring for their dues and their duties. But the Bible would teach us, I may have a freedom, it doesn't necessarily mean that I would use it. There can be other things that would come into the picture that may mean that even though I'm entitled, legally entitled to something, these other considerations might mean that I will take a different course of action and I may forego some of my entitlements. Here's a very crude illustration. Tomorrow, at broad daylight, I want to go to Ballymena. I've got a car, taxed, insured, and I have a driving license. I get into the car, and I'm free to go up the dual carriageway there to Ballymena. Everything legal. No one can stop me. When I'm cruising up there, about 50 miles an hour, just somewhere up in the carriageway, there's an old lady steps out on her walking stick, 250 yards ahead. Now I'm free to move right along that carriageway. I'm entitled to the road. But now this lady has moved out. And I have to ask myself the question, do I pursue my freedom? Legally licensed in this vehicle for this road, do I pursue my freedom? Or do I recognize that across my pathway there has come a figure unexpectedly, and do I make the safety of that old lady more important than my freedom? So that now that she has moved out, she may not be legally entitled to cross the carriageway. She may not be within her rights. But I have to slow down. And I maybe have to move into a corridor that I didn't expect to be taking. And I will adjust the use of my freedom just for the benefit of this person that has appeared. Now, I have the freedom, but because I have it, I don't necessarily use it if it's going to be used at the expense of other people. Now, I know other things, that's not a perfect illustration by any means. Other things could be brought into the picture, but in a broad sense, it will show just exactly what we're talking about here. So that we'll cover these three particular areas. The first one, as I say, in chapter number 7, the Apostle Paul is dealing with the question of marriage. Now, it is unfortunate we have to abbreviate this whole thing. And 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is a question. There are not many questions in it, but there have been many questions about it. So that we'll have to be very, very brief. Now, when you read the chapter, there'll be one or two conclusions that you would come to. Just, they stare one in the face. When the Apostle Paul is thinking of what we call Christian marriage, I know that marriage is a creatorial institution, but I'm talking about two Christians being married. First of all, that marriage is exclusive. It's one man and one woman. Any third party in that marriage, in an intimate way, the Bible makes it clear, is sin. Not only is marriage exclusive, but marriage is normal. On the general run of the mill, in the general course of humanity, it is the expected, natural, normal thing that people would, they're perfectly free to get married. God has instituted it. It's exclusive, it's natural, it's normal, it's scriptural, it has the sanction of the Word of God, and fourthly, it's permanent. He said once the marriage takes place, it's for life. The woman is bound to her husband as long as he liveth. Now those broad things are indisputable in connection with marriage. And the Apostle Paul makes it very, very clear that everyone is free to get married. Now I have in my mind a sneaky little suspicion that not everybody at Corinth agreed with him. And I think there were some wiseacres, super spiritual people, if you like, at Corinth. And they were promoting the idea, an idea that has been promoted in religion right down the ages, that for a person not to get married or to remain celibate brings that person into a higher spiritual class. And there's something more spiritual about the single state. And to get married and engage in marriage relations is something carnal and something that is unacceptable to people who want to be spiritual high flyers. Now the Apostle Paul absolutely revolts against that. He said, I'll tell you the truth. He said, if you're going to impose the legislation that people to be really, really spiritual must remain single or must be celibate, he said, I'll tell you what you'll end up doing. He said, instead of making them more spiritual, you'll actually encourage them to sin. He said, for the people will just simply not physically or emotionally be able to contain that kind of a restriction. And he says, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife. So he gives his full signature to the dignity and to the scriptural acceptability of marriage. But then he says, now my preference would be, he said, I don't legislate this for anyone else. He said, my personal preference would be to be single. Now, whether the Apostle Paul never had been married or whether he was a widower, I'm not altogether sure. Bible scholars have debated down the ages. I myself would wonder if he hadn't previously been married and so on, but I'm not going into those particular details tonight. He was certainly single, as he writes this particular... He said, now, my preference would lean toward the single state. When you look down through the passage, you'll come to this conclusion as well, that at least the section that I'm thinking about now, for example, the Apostle Paul says, are you bound to a wife? And he's speaking to betrothed people, I take it, in this section concerning virgins, but I don't. He says, are you bound to a wife? Seek not to be loose. He says, are you loose? Seek not to be bound. But he said, if you're married, he says, you haven't sinned. That's if the man marries, he hasn't sinned. And he says, if the girl marries, she hasn't sinned. So that he's not talking. Now that we need to get this very, very clear, because this is very important in the whole question of Christian liberty. He's not talking in this section of the chapter about what is black and white. He's not talking about what is right and wrong. He's not saying it's right to be single, it's wrong to be married. It's not right and wrong. He's not even talking about good and bad. He's talking about good and better. Good and better. Now he says, if a person gets married, he says, very good. He says, I can't point a finger. He says, God doesn't point a finger. He says, pure marriage is something that is honourable and all. He said, that is good. But he said, I think, he said, because of the present distress
And because of the present necessity, that it would be better to remain single. Now you see, if you go right to the end of the chapter, for example, he says about the lady, the wife is bound by her husband, this widow, as long as her husband liveth, but if her husband is at liberty to be married to whom she will only in the Lord, but she is happier. No, he says she'd be happy if she gets married to another man in the Lord. But he says, I think she'll be even happier. Just a verse or two before that, he says, such and such a man, he said, if he does such and such, and he marries his virgin, he says, he'll do well. But he says, if he doesn't, I think he'll be doing even better. Now, I hope you get the point, for that will be very, very important. The apostle is not talking about bad and good, but he's talking about good and about better. Now, why? How do you judge whether a thing will be better or whether it will just be good? How do you aim higher? What was the criterion which the Apostle Paul used to make this decision or to give this advice or to make this suggestion? Well, he says, I'll put it just like this. If thou marry, thou hast not sinned. If a virgin marry, she hath not sinned. Nevertheless, such, that is, those who do marry, such shall have trouble in the flesh. He says there will be trouble. I tell you, there's trouble enough for a person living on his own. And then to live with another person, it's double trouble. You'll have trouble in the flesh. And you, dear boys here today, who are not yet married, all I will say to you is this. It's bad enough washing dishes for one, but when you have to wash dishes for two, so you may be very, very careful. He said, now there will be trouble. He said, I'm a practical man. He said, on a serious note, married life does have shared responsibility. It has many shared joys. It can have tensions. It can have difficulties. There can be family responsibilities. Instead of thinking about one, you have to think about two. He said, the married man has to think about the things of his wife. But he said, the man who's single, he can attend upon the things of the Lord without distraction. Now he said, the reason I prefer the single state is not because I say thou shalt be single, not because the Bible says thou shalt be single. He said, there's absolute freedom. But he said, I have made the decision that in my life, he said, this is the state which gives me the maximum freedom to serve the Lord to the greatest advantage. Now that will be very, very important. That's a very simple thing. It has taken quite a while just to arrive at that. But you know, that's a big consideration in questions of Christian freedom. Not just thinking now about marriage relationships, although we have that in the background, any of our relationships. Going into any association, going into any partnership, I ask myself the question, if I go into this partnership, is it going to help me to serve the Lord? Is it going to increase my devotion to Christ? Is it going to be consistent with my loyalty to Him? Indeed, the brethren have often told us that in the first epistle to the Corinthians, the Lord is mentioned repeatedly. And I think from memory, it's something like 70 times. Some of you brethren that have counted it, I haven't counted it recently, but one thing I am sure of, out of the 16 chapters, there is no chapter that mentions the Lord as often as chapter 7. So Paul says, in this question of liberty, and he said, you're faced with a choice, and you can go this way, and you can go that way, and neither way is wrong. He said, you're not talking about black and white, you're talking about two shades of grey. And he said, you're just not sure which of these avenues you should take. He says, I'll tell you, you take the avenue which will, to the greatest extent, reflect the Lordship of Christ. Now, of course,
when we apply that. We're talking here about principles, you see. Many Christians want to know about guidance. And I get here questions, and the other brethren hear far more questions than I would, about how do I know the Lord's guidance, and all these different things. We can't go into every detail. What about a young sister goes to work in wherever? And by and by she gets friendly, just in her work with another chap in the office. He's a clean living, clean cut chap, no nonsense about him, very courteous, very thoughtful, very helpful. And after a while he asks this young sister for a date. She has previously been bitterly disappointed by some of the young men and their misdemeanors in the assembly. She has been scarred emotionally because of the flighty habits of some of the young brethren. This is a young man who seems to have a bucketful, much more character than they had, but there's one problem, he's not a Christian. Now it's lovely sitting in a meeting talking about this, but I tell you, that's a difficult thing when the pressure's off. We're talking now about a young sister, maybe in her 20s. And I really think, brethren, I was mentioning this in another meeting, and I'm going away down the track now offhand. I think that many of our older brethren, up to whom we have looked for years and still do, but I think that many of them, because of the generation change, they have little idea about how many pressures are on young people and people in their 20s. Now you take a young person, give me, I'm away with it here, the freedom of the clock, that's what I would love to have, the freedom of the clock, but no matter. You take a young person, into their late teens, undergoing great physical changes, the great surges of adolescence sweeping through their being. At the same time, they're in the middle of academic studies, A-levels and so on. At the very same time, they maybe have to encounter the challenge of going from college, high school, whatever, to university. And they're catapulted into a great big world, totally alien to what they may previously have known. They're making new friendships. They're trying to make a mark. They're looking for significance. They're going on to higher studies. They're wondering about a career. They're worrying about trying to find a job. And all those pressures from different angles are just being focused upon them. And if I can say to you, the dear older brethren in the meeting, if you have any in the assembly in that situation or that age group, you help them all you can, because they need it. They need support. And they need to have your door open. And they need to have an ear. And can I say, there is one thing that they will need to have with you. That will be confidentiality. And if they come and they breathe out their problems, you will have to listen. And all these, and I talked about this young sister and this fine young gentleman, and what you going to do? Well, the thing, she say, well, what harm is there in it? Like, really, I'm free in a sense. I'm free. And there's no one in the assembly has made any recent advances. Well, the only thing that will really keep her steady in that particular thing is loyalty to the Lordship of Christ. That I have to be faithful. Now, if you go ahead and you marry that young man, I do not doubt, if he is the clean young man that we have been thinking about, I do not doubt that you'll have happy times together. And you can go shopping together. And you can go sightseeing together. And you could go holidaying together and many, many different things. But remember, no matter how good a day you have, when you come home, you'll not be able to pray together. And you'll not be able to read the scriptures together. And you will have found that by marrying that young man, you have locked yourself into a relationship where the Lord is not recognized.
and the word of the Lord and the presence of the Lord is not sure.
You said a minute or two ago that marriage is creatorial, it's not Christian. Yes, I still say that 100% Genesis chapter 2 and so on. But I would say this, that there is a dimension to a Christian marriage that gives it a richness and a depth, where a couple can have the presence of the Lord and can pray. And if you marry not in the Lord, and I would say to younger brethren and sisters, and I may be slightly criticized for this, but just give me a little liberty. This is a night of liberty. I would say, don't only marry a Christian, but exercise before the Lord. Do your best to marry someone in your own tribe. I think you know what I mean by that. We are losing many. And I cannot understand where the teaching is gone. And I cannot understand where the assembly conviction is gone. And they grow up in the assembly, they're received into the assembly 16, 17, 18, and when it comes to the time for making relationships, they can only find a suitable partner amongst systems that have absolutely nothing in common with assembly ground. And then they drift away one after another. I feel, dear brothers and sisters, that we need to take a hard look at where we're going and what's happening and why so many people are drifting away. Are they not being told? I don't know. Certainly, when I was a cub, the dear men that were doing what I'm trying to do just now, they told us. And it makes me fear at times, this business of preaching, I tell you, it's no pastime. I wonder if many of the problems that are coming up down there haven't started here on the platform. If things are not being taught, and things are not being played, oh, you say, but I love to have prophetical ministry, I love it myself. And I love to have devotional ministry. I revel in it when I hear my brethren at it. But dear brethren, there needs to be plain practical ministry. Because we are living in days when the pressure for change is on. And the ground is slipping from beneath our feet. And if we are not careful, what we have treasured in assembly testimony will just be pulled like a cloth and leave us spinning, wondering what we've been doing. We need to be very, very clear on these matters. Difficult days, relationships. Now the Apostle Paul, what you really need to decide is this. Do I want to do well? Or do I want to be fairly good? Or am I going to aim a little bit higher? And not just settle for what's good, but settle for what is better. And the Apostle Paul says, he says, in this great question of making decisions, he says, that, he said, will be a guideline for the grey area. Does this reflect my loyalty to the Lord Jesus? Now, that's a very sketchy thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, I'll admit. But on the subject of liberty, I think it's touching the main principle. And if you read down the chapter, all those references to the Lord and attending upon the Lord and attending upon the Lord without distraction, you can see that it will fit in with just what I'm saying. And those of us who are married, it wouldn't do us any harm just to take a look at our marriage tonight in light of this. Can I speak to you sisters, if you forgive me, an amateur like myself, forgive me for doing it just for a minute. Maybe when you first got married, you had an equal commitment to the Lord with your husband. And maybe the assembly was first, and the things of the Lord were first, and you encouraged him and made every sacrifice so that the things of the Lord, that he could put his best into them. Now, maybe after a period of time, you have cooled towards the Lord and you're demanding more attention. And you're taking from the time that your husband could spend with his Bible and the time that he could spend for the assembly, you're demanding that for yourself. And you're creating an impossible situation where your husband cannot give the Lord the portion that he expected to give him. when marriage was first entered into. It's great if we could be together in marriage just with that equal commitment to the Lord. You know exactly what I'm saying, and I don't want to elaborate upon it any further. Well, so much for relationships and the Lord. What about this business of meats? You see, that was a big crux at Corinth. I think I said the other night that immorality was rife in the city of Corinth, and of course with immorality there was also idolatry. It pervaded and covered the whole place. Now, nearly every facet of life was in some way or another linked to some idol's temple. Corinth in those ancient times and other Greek cities, they had guilds, businessmen, you know, bankers' guilds and accountants' guilds and butchers' guilds and farmers' guilds, nearly a little bit like what we would have as unions or trade unions. Now, every one of those guilds would have had one of the gods or the goddesses as its patron. And of course, when it came to the annual general meeting, and they were reading out the accounts for the guild, they had a great big dinner in honour of the god or the goddess that had prospered them. Now, that was a very typical thing for a Christian. But I suppose there wasn't maybe not too many of the Christians had a real problem there. Many of the drama scenes, the proceeds went to the upkeep of some of the temples. So even drama, whether it was business, whether it was social life, whether it was entertainment, it was all linked in some way with the idol's temple. Another side that is not mentioned so often is this. Many of the idol's temples had great courtyards, not exactly in the religious enclosure as such, but they had great courtyards and colonnades, and many of those were turned into cafeterias or restaurants, some of them very high class. And of course, if you came to your 25th wedding anniversary and you were taking all the family out and you wanted something just a little bit special, and you would say, well, the best place in Corinth that we can go is to the Zeus restaurant, the big temple to Zeus, and just beside his temple he had a marvellous great big high flying restaurant. Now, it wasn't exactly inside the temple, but it was closely associated with the temple. Or if you were going out for a birthday celebration or for an anniversary or any of those things, the chances were that you would go for your meal into some building that was fairly closely connected with the idol's temple, so that you could have an idolatrous feast, just plain pure idolatry, at some particular festival. Well, the Christian didn't have much problem there. He didn't go. But then, what about going to some of these restaurants? Still officially linked. Now, you weren't having a religious feast, or you weren't having a religious meal. It was just a family meal, or whatsoever. Was it all right to go to one of them? Well, it was there. It was in that area that the opinion divided. Now, there was a brother called Sam Strong in the assembly at Corinth, and he had absolutely no problem. He knew that they had old ladies, nothing at all. Nothing, there's nothing to it, this way of kind of talking to us. He had the knowledge. He was well grounded in his theology, and he had a third degree in theology, and he had no problem. He could go with the whole thing. It was just a good steak, and that was all he just thought about. But then there was another brother called William Week. And William Week, he wasn't so sure, because he had been brought up an idolater, and for the first 30 years of his life he had been saturated with it. And even to go back down to that restaurant and the smell and the sights and the sounds, everything would just take him back to his old days, and he thought it just wasn't right. And he couldn't bring himself, his conscience just couldn't bring this. The Strong brother, he thought, no problem at all. Now, what are you going to do there? What are we going to do? It is a problem. Now the Apostle Paul says you have to be careful here.
He says, if you the strong brother, he says, if you go, and he says, this weaker brother looks up to you, because he knows that you're a man with knowledge. And he says, out of respect for you, he says, you may drag him underground that's beyond what his conscience allows. And you would drag him onto territory that is beyond his knowledge. And he would sit, and he would take the meal, and he would be at your anniversary dinner. But he said, what you would have done to him, he says, could damage him for life. I says, you get no problem. You get away, you come home, you go to sleep that night and never think another thing about it. Just as if you'd been down at the Scandi or something. He'll never give it a second thought. And you say, well, go to McDonald's the next time. And we not get involved in that kind of thing. No, but this week, brother, he comes home. And he can't sleep. And he has got a flavour again for idolatry. And maybe he drops out of the meetings a bit. And he says, because of what you have done and because of where you have gone, and he says, you have pulled this dear man beyond his conscience, he says, that weak brother will perish. And that doesn't mean that he'll miss heaven or he'll be in hell. But it just means that he'll be lost as far as his testimony is concerned. So that, here's a matter of freedom. Well, Paul says, no, I agree. He says, I agree the idol's nothing. And he says, I agree that in strict principle and in strict black and white, he says, you could go. He said, you're free to go. He said, there's no scriptural principle being infringed by you going to have your anniversary meal. Just, he says, you're perfectly free. But he said, I think in this case, he says that you should forego your freedom for the benefit of that other brother. And of course, the weight of the whole thing comes in when the apostle just adds these words. He says, the weak brother will perish for whom Christ died. And Paul says, tell me. He says, do you see that brother? He says, for that brother, Christ was ready to give up his life. He says, should you not be ready to give up your liberty? If Christ has given so much, he says, why is it that you're prepared to give just so little? So he said, there's the brother that's weak, and then there's the brother that's wounded, and then there's the brother that was worth the very blood of Christ. Now, that I can't develop that much more from the passage, but I would say this. A number of things very important there. What I do and where I go, I have to be very careful about what effect my actions would have on other people. You know, we're living in an individualistic world. It's becoming more like that. Now, for recent years, we all can see, I hear them tell stories about the old days, no cars, and people walking down the street and on the bicycle, the doors lying open. They hadn't the security problems of these recent times. People in and out of houses, and people chatting and talking, and all that. There was a sort of a community spirit even in this very land. You know what it is now. You go to your driveway, you press your button, your garage door goes up, you slip into the garage, you have a side door into the house. The people out there never see you. The most they will get, and the most they will give, is a wave of the hand. And we are individualistic, and whole societies have become separated and dichotomized, and the idea is we live to ourselves, and if we're all right, we'll be all right, and you look after yourself. And that's the very opposite of Christianity. Paul said in chapter 7, he said, if you're going to make a choice, he said, you have to think how that choice reflects upon the Lord. Now he says in chapter 8, he says, you have to think how that choice reflects upon your brother. Be right with the Lord, consecrate it to him, and he says, have concern about your brother.
course, that's just back to the beginning of the Bible. When men got out of touch with God in chapter 3, one of the first things you hear a man say in chapter 4 is, "Am I my brother's keeper?" We should feel, I can't just live to myself. I have to be very, very careful. Now, it's not just, I would need to say this. When it talks about offending a brother in a passage like this, it's not talking about hurting his feelings. It's far more serious. It's talking about me doing something that will have the potential to destroy his testimony. Not just that he'll be hurt in his feelings, but he could actually stumble and fall into sin. Now may the Lord give us a conscience, so that if I'm going to do anything, even an assembly like this comes into a far in a different sphere, but the same principle, whatever I'm doing in assembly life, I have to ask, what repercussions will this have upon another Christian? Of course, it can't always be applied, and many folks want to apply this passage into situations where it's not strictly relevant. I remember working with a dear man. He belonged to a group of a denomination that had been able to make a colourful blend of politics and Christianity, and he had some very strong convictions on certain areas, and many things we shared in common. One of the things that we had an equal conviction about was that we didn't buy Sunday papers. I'm sure maybe quite a few in the meeting tonight don't buy Sunday papers either. I well remember how aghast he was when he saw me coming in one day with a Monday paper. And I was taken aback. I said, "Richard, what's the problem?" "Oh," he says, "that's terrible," he says. "That's terrible." He says, "You wouldn't buy Sunday." "No, no, I don't buy Sunday." He says, "Neither would I." He says, "I wouldn't buy Monday papers because they're printed on Sunday." He says, that's terrible. Now you say, what did you do? You say, did you stop buying Monday papers out of respect to your brother? Well, you see, if I had treated him as the weaker brother, I don't think he would have been impressed. He actually thought I was the weak one, buying the Monday papers that were printed on Sunday. He was the strong man. He was the strong man that wouldn't do it. I was the weak one that did do it. Actually, in 1 Corinthians, it's the weak one that won't do it. It's the strong one that can do it. So that we have to be very, very careful that we don't apply the principle of 1 Corinthians just to petty things. I'll admit it's difficult. We talk about the principle, but it's difficult just to find an exact replica for our own day. But nevertheless, let me be careful. May you be careful that our actions don't have the effect of bringing spiritual damage to another conscientious Christian. Finally, chapter 9. There is a liberty here. I'll have to describe the liberty for a minute. The liberty is that the Apostle Paul expresses the entitlement for him to take financial help from the people amongst whom he was labouring. Now he says, there's absolutely no question. He says, I have that entitlement. You see, there are people, and they boast about not doing things, but they're not entitled to do them anyway. So there's no point boasting. They're only making a song and dance about nothing. And he says, if I'm going to mention that I don't use this liberty, he says, I want to tell you that I really have it. I have this liberty. And actually, we won't go through it at this stage in the meeting, but in chapter 9, it's the one place in this epistle where we get 10 questions, one after another. Non-stop. From verse 4 down to verse 10 of chapter 10 questions, and with those 10 questions, the Apostle Paul proves that he is the... He says, look at the other apostles, they do it. So he says, I could do it. He says, I have apostolic example. He says, does Peter and Barnabas? He says, surely they do. He says, look at everyday life. He said, the man that's the farmer, he gets the first taste of the goods. The man that's the shepherd, he gets the first of the milk and so on, the wool. And so he said, everyday life, that shows that I'm entitled to it. He says, look at the Lord Jesus said. He said, the Lord Jesus said that the laborer is worthy of his hire. So he said, the other apostles, everyday life, the Lord Jesus. He said, the priests in the temple.
He says they get a bit of the altar. When they work at the altar, they get a bit from it. He says, no. He says, logic. He says, I get to use spiritual things. He says, it shouldn't be counted unfair if I take back material things. He said, there's absolutely no doubt that I was entitled to this. And he has all those different arguments that I don't go into in detail. Even the word of Christ for it. And then, when you get down there to verse number, the end of verse number 12, you get this big nevertheless. He says, now I have this power, but he says, nevertheless, I don't use it. I don't use it. That's what I was starting with. It's one thing to have a right. And we are living in an age where everyone's claiming his or her rights. It's one thing to have it. But the true expression of real freedom is to be so free that I'm free not to use my freedom. That sounds paradox. Paul says, now I have the freedom to be financially supported. But he said, I have forgone that. Why? Why? If I forgo a freedom, I must have some higher purpose. Well, he said, the reason that I forgo that freedom is just lest I should hinder the gospel of Christ. He said, I'm doing it for a greater advantage. I don't want to hinder the gospel. Later down the chapter, he really turns the thing around the other way. He says, the reason that I have refrained from using this right is not just that I don't want to hinder the gospel, but he says, I want to save as many as possible. I was wondering, what could we give up that might help the gospel? I may be off beam here altogether, but you'll tolerate that just at the end of the meeting. We are living in a mollycoddle, in a society mollycoddled by materialism. We'll all admit that. By the standards of many parts in the world, Christians in Northern Ireland live in relative luxury. I'm entitled to it. I'm entitled to it. I work hard. I work 40 hours a week. Not a boy like you, you work 5. And if you have sick, you work 6 hours if you have a meeting on a Saturday night. We work 40 hours a week and we work hard. And I'm entitled to it. And we have got a good big house and we're entitled to it. My husband, myself, and we get our good holiday every year to as an exotic a place as can be imagined. And we work for it and we have a car. And we have the best model of the car and every last gadget. And it must be the finest. We are entitled to it. I know you're entitled to it. I know you are. And we get the best clothes, designer model clothes. Nothing less will do. We're entitled to it. We're entitled to it. Entitled to it. We are free to have it. We earn the money. So don't you dare to tell me how to spend my money. I'm free to spend it whatever way I like. Well, of course you're entitled to it. You're entitled to that house. I have a good house too. And I have a good car. And I have reasonable clothes. And you can see I have a fair amount of food. And you all say, you're entitled to it as well. What I was wondering is this. Would there be any possibility that we could give up some of our entitlements for the sake of the gospel? Would less fancy houses do it? That we might promote the gospel? Would less standard of clothing do us? Would smaller cars do us? Would fewer holidays do us? Just that we might promote the gospel. Paul says, I don't worry about giving up my right to this entitlement. For he said, if I can see a few souls at God's right hand, saved from the eternal burning, he says that will be more reward to me than any pennies that I could ever get in Corinth. Dear brethren and sisters, when all said and done, I don't always think like this. But all said and done, our houses and our cars, and all the things that I have mentioned, what will those things count if we stand in glory and see a few souls saved from everlasting fire? May we be prepared to give up. You know, we really think that we should. What you say was all right for Paul. It was easy enough for him. I tell you, it wasn't easy for him. Now, because he gave this up, the refusal to take this entitlement had a specific reason, the good of the gospel. But the result of refusing to take this, if you had been away yonder about 2 o'clock in the morning, you see an oil lamp burning. And after the meeting, you're going out shaking hands with this fellow Paul some night, and you'd have got a little. You see, then, you don't mind me asking, mister, what are those big welts on your arm? Oh, I said, it's all right, it's all right. And he was working like a slave at night, making tents. To keep body and soul together, so that he might preach the gospel free of charge throughout the day. And because he refused this, it was a great personal cost. You say, I think you've hit the mark there, that's a good idea for you. Just you go home and start making tents in the back of Dolidgetown, and it'll be the best thing ever happened to work in Northern Ireland. Well, I don't know, but you see the point. A little bit of suffering, a little bit less, a little bit hardship for ourselves, that we might hinder the gospel. I wonder, oh please forgive me for saying this. I wonder, brothers and sisters, I do want, and if there's anyone guilty here, it is myself. I acknowledge total guilt and complicity. We are about the streets and giving out little things and so on to get people into God, and we're talking about eternity, and we're trying to get people ready for heaven. And one of the reasons we can hardly do it is that people see that we are so keen on earth. And we talk about eternity, but we mustn't really believe it, for we're so materialistic. Now Paul says, I suffer materially that I may reach others spiritually. Now just as I close, you'll have to go back through that. If I've got a decision to make in life, for which there is no specific word in the Bible, black and white, right and wrong, it's a grey area. What will guide me out of tonight's meeting? First of all, in chapter 7, I'll ask, how does this work with my relationship with the Lord? Secondly, from chapter 8, I'll ask, how will this affect my relationship with my fellow Christians? Thirdly, from chapter 9, I'll ask, how will this affect the parish world around me? And if I take those three things, the Lord, fellow believers, and the perishing world, if I take those into account, I think we'd find it easier to make our decisions in those indifferent, neutral things of life. Questions about liberty, guidelines for the grey areas. May the Lord help us with these sketchy principles for our lives as the days go by, shall we pray?